cap and trade. Ladies and gentlemen, take a big deep breath and hold it. Now the incorrect among us will exhale too much carbon dioxide, and their exhalations must be capped. To provide for the continued existence, we will allow the incorrect to trade for the right to exhale more CO2 from the correct, who, being the correct, are allowed to exhale more CO2 than is contained in their lungs. Cap and trade. Now, all this heavy breathing leads us to ask, who will win and who will lose with cap and trade? Whew.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 644th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer, Food Chain's very own, Miss Idaho, Nikki J. Folks, they say the earth is warming and we are at fault, and therefore we must do something about ourselves to cool things down. So here's the plan. The government will sell permits to emit greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. Each emitter will have a cap on how much gas he or she may emit. The incorrect among us will emit too much gas and will have to trade with the correct among us for the indulgences to emit more gas. The correct can sell indulgences because they are permitted to emit more gas than they have to emit. We call this plan cap and trade, and the legislation is currently being worked through the U.S. Senate at the hands of Barbara Boxer and John Kerry. To get the legislation through the U.S. House, representatives from farm states were promised that farmers would be included in the list of the correct. That is, farmers and landholders would be allowed to sell indulgences to the incorrect and thereby make a lot of money. But wait, there appears to be a difference of opinion as to the efficacy of cap and trade among the producers of our nation's food. The National Farmers Union, whose 4,000 producers and 5 million acres represent the nation's largest aggregator of carbon offsets, is for cap and trade. But the American Farm Bureau Federation, the nation's largest farm membership organization, believes cap and trade will increase farmers' costs and reduce their competitiveness. And so today we pause to ask, who will win and who will lose in the cap and trade legislation? With us today we have Rick Krause, who's a senior director of regulator relations for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Rick, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
So are you one of those Washington, D.C. farmers?
Yes, I am.
Good for you. And we certainly need a lot of farmers in Washington, D.C., or probably we would be in a big, deep doo-doo out here in the heartland, would we not?
Yes. Somebody needs to keep them a little bit out.
A little bit online, yeah. So tell us about the American Farm Bureau Federation. What are you?
American Farm Bureau Federation is what they call a general farm organization. That means that we represent all of the different commodities that farmers and ranchers produce. We are in every state and Puerto Rico, and we have over 6 million member families.
Lots of farmers.
Yes.
And who pays your way?
Our way is paid solely by dues that come from individual farmers.
Okay.
And they join a county farm bureau, and county farm bureau is a member of a state farm bureau, and the state farm bureau is a member of the American Farm Bureau. So we are a true grassroots, bottom-up organization.
Very good. And starting at the local level with the county farm bureaus and going all the way up to the nation's capital with the American Farm Bureau Federation. Also with us today, we have John Hansen, who's president of the Nebraska Farmers Union and also the chair of the National Farmers Union's Legislative Committee. John, welcome to the Food Chain.
It's good to be here.
So a Nebraska farmer, right?
Yes.
And I understand that the Nebraska Farmers Union was actually founded in Texas. How did that happen?
Well, the National Farmers Union was originally founded in Texas in 1902, and then the organization of farmers union around the country spread from state to state. In our home state of Nebraska, we were organized starting in 1911.
Okay, good. What is the National Farmers Union?
We're the second oldest, second largest general farm organization in the country. We represent all different kinds of farmers who grow all different kinds of crops. We small, large farmers in between, traditional farmers, organic farmers, all different kinds of folks. And we are also a grassroots organization. We have 250,000 farm and ranch families from around the country that set our policy and that we represent.
So who pays your way then?
Our income is primarily from dues.
From dues. Okay, good. Well, the first question I have is, what's the difference between the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Farmers Union? Let's start with you, Rick.
I think we kind of both want the same goals. I think it's an issue from us on this legislation as to how we get there. We both, both of our organizations have worked together to try to get as good a provision for farmers and ranchers as we can. I think we differ a little bit on the impact that this legislation might have on climate.
Mm-hmm.
For example, our experts that we have read about say that this legislation is only going to have an impact of maybe 0.2 of a degree by 2050, and that's if everything in this thing works perfectly. So it really has very little impact on climate.
But is there something about the American? I mean, both of your organizations took opposite sides of this legislation, it appears, and I'm just wondering if there's something intrinsically different about your organizations that would encourage you to come up with opposite sides of the question here. Or are you basically the same kinds of organizations?
We basically are. I think we took a look at it and we said that for maybe 0.2 of a degree difference, that the increased cost that we're going to be incurred by farmers and ranchers as a result of this, it just wasn't worth it.
Okay, John Hansen, is there something about that distinguishes your two organizations that would encourage you to come up with different sides of the issue? Can you see anything?
Well, I think that we're both general farm organizations. I think Farmers Union has historically been more aggressive in looking at ways to create new ag-based markets with renewable energy. We've been probably much more aggressive when you look at both the state and the national organizations on the development of ethanol, biofuels, farmer-owned wind energy, all of those kinds of renewable things. So this issue is one that we've worked on for a very long time. In our case, I've been working on carbon issues since the mid-90s. We helped put in place the mechanism to help create the Chicago Climate Exchange. We want farmers to play a constructive and proactive role in being able to participate in real carbon reduction as we move forward. And so in our view, as you compare the regulatory choices before us, the cap and trade approach is much more flexible. It provides a new market for agriculture,
substantial
revenue source.
And the American Farmers Union is, seems to be more inclined to get behind these kinds of things than the American Farm Bureau Federation. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I think we share some common ground on some of these things. I think as you look at it historically, Farmers Union has just been much more aggressive and proactive.
Okay. I guess when we start off here with respect to cap and trade, say it gets, approved by the Senate, it's approved by the House, they get together and they work out the differences and everything's fine. Who will decide who may emit what? Let's go with you, John. Who's gonna decide who can emit and who can't?
Well, if you have mandatory caps in place, the language itself of the law will will determine the goals for the sectors.
Okay.
And what the emission levels are, and then
who will set those? So that will be written into law. Then everybody will have the ability to emit this much, and if you emit more than that, then you'll have to work with somebody who's emitting less than this to get your.
And maybe Rick has more detailed information than I do, but my understanding is that generally they'll look at levels for sectors, and then EPA will be in charge of helping set the specifics for helping meet those targets or goals by sector.
Okay, we're gonna have to take a quick break, Rick. So can you hold on? We'll pick you up when we come back, and we'll talk with Rory too. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We are today talking about cap and trade. Cap emissions and trade them with partners. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
They say we are emitting too much greenhouse gas, and we're warming up the world too much, and we must do something about it. And by golly, it's we who have to do something about ourselves. So the plan is called cap and trade. We're going to cap the amount of emissions that we can release, and those who need more emission capability, we're going to have to trade for those who don't use as much. And that's the way of it, cap and trade. Who's going to win and who's going to lose? That's the question today. And we have Rick Krause with the American Farm Bureau Federation, and we have John Hansen, who is with the National Farmers Union, and two big, huge, giant farm organizations, and both of them seem to be headed in the opposite directions on this question, so we're trying to work our way through that. Rick, we were talking a little bit about who's going to make the decisions here on what's what. So is it going to be like, are we going to have like an army of bureaucrats to, you know, running around saying you can emit that and you can't emit that? How's this going to work?
Now, John was correct that the legislation, the way it's designed, will indicate in the law by sector what amount each sector is permitted to emit.
Mm-hmm.
EPA, I think, will be the ones that they will allocate what they call emission allowances are, which is the permissions to emit. The EPA will allocate those to the different sectors that are regulated under this. We do envision kind of a growing bureaucracy as a result of this to administer the program and to enforce it. At this point in time, agriculture is not one of the sectors that they're proposing to regulate emissions, simply because there's just too many farmers in the country that it would create horrendous enforcement problems. But the way that agriculture gets impacted is by those entities, those utility companies and oil refineries, oil companies that do have to cap their emissions, that those increases in cost that they will incur will be passed on down the line to consumers, which includes farmers and ranchers.
Okay,
and
that's
where farmers and ranchers will get their increased cost.
Okay, I'd like to pick that one up just down the line a little bit. Right now we're going to pick up Rory, who has a question. Rory, welcome to the Food Chain. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, to the rep from the Farmers Union, I'd like to ask him, when is this farce of global climate change driven by man and or, in other words, anthropogenic global climate change, global warming. When is this farce going to end? We're in a 11-year cooling trend right now, and I have to ask you, if you've studied carbon since the mid-90s, you know that carbon dioxide presently is about 350 parts per million of the atmosphere. That equals 0.00035 parts of the atmosphere, or in a percentage, 0.035%.
I'm fogging over, Rory.
You tell me how anything that's 0.035% of the atmosphere is going to cause this cataclysm when it goes from 350 ppm up to 400 or 450 or whatever the projections are.
Okay.
This is a farce. And I'll make one little editorial comment before I listen to the answer. This is going to drive the cost of living up unnecessarily for the average American citizen. Okay, it's going to push a lot of people down into poverty. They don't even know it. And I suggest that this farmers union that's invested heavily in ethanol and wind power has got ulterior motives because they can't compete with oil and coal and gas.
Oh.
So when's this farce going to end, sir?
Thank you very much, Rory. John, I guess that's questions for you.
Well, I think that there's a very minority, but very hardcore group of folks who continue to believe that that global warming is not going on and
mm-hmm.
that it's not real and that there's somehow not a relationship between the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere and the amount of temperature. I'm looking right now at a chart on my computer screen that goes back for 420,000 years. It is an old computer, but it is a slide in our PowerPoint presentation that takes the data from the Vostok ice core in Antarctica and through all of the very high-end testing that they're able to do in the amount of stored carbon in those ice cores that they drill and test. They can determine the amount of carbon in the atmosphere going back for 420,000 years. And so as you look at increases in carbon in the atmosphere, there's a corresponding increase and a separate chart as you look at temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it, to me, when you look at the issue of taking all of the coal and all of the oil stored carbon and releasing it into the atmosphere that we do when we use fossil fuel-based energy, there certainly has to be, however you slice it, there has to be an additional amount of total carbon released into the atmosphere that we had before that was not a part of the natural cycling system. So whether you believe that human beings have an impact on global warming or not, I take the point of view that doesn't matter. It's in our interest to do everything we can as a society to minimize the adverse impacts of these cycles, and there's going to be very substantial climate change. Agriculture is going to be at the forefront of that climate change. We need to minimize that, not only for agriculture, but for civilization as a whole.
Okay, well, wait a minute.
The sooner we get started, the more flexible we can be, the more proactive we can be. And, you know, if Rory's wrong, we're in big trouble.
Rick, does the American Farm Bureau Federation buy into it, like to the extent that the National Farmers Union does? Are we?
Well, we're not really a scientific organization, but from all the things that we have seen and read and heard and have explained to us by scientists, the last 11 years have been a cooling trend, which our knowledge, the models that model global warming have not taken into account.
Mm-hmm.
The scientists are telling us that regardless of whether we're causing anything or not, that the bill that's currently being considered in Congress, assuming that everything works perfectly, they assume it will, and that's a big if, that that bill will impact world climate by maybe 0.2 degrees.
Okay.
And so we just don't think that, that this bill really does what John is hoping it to do.
Well, you know, I saw in the paper this morning, I think it was, maybe it was yesterday morning, the fact that New York City is experiencing its second coldest summer on record. And, John, if New York City is really that cold, what's going on? Is it, is this 11-year trend just an aberration in your modeling then?
Well, it's not our modeling. It's looking at the preponderance of scientific data.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the Earth is a very complicated interacting entities where, you know, we have all these impacts from the streaming of ocean currents to winds to all these kinds of things. So you can pick out specific spots and you can look at that. But when you look at the overall amount of data, you know, it certainly would indicate that we are in uncharted territory relative to the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and the overall global temperature. Those two things stand out.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll pick this up. It seems to me like when it comes to global warming, you can pretty much pick up enough evidence to point to exactly whatever it is you want it to point to. Some can say there's incontrovertible evidence that there is global warming, and the other side can say, yeah, but it's not. Look at this evidence, and there you are. So we're in this situation, but we do have cap and trade on the table, and we do want to ask who will win and who will lose with cap and trade and food. We will be right back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with you today. You know, they say that there are some among us who are exhaling way too much carbon dioxide, and their exhalations must be capped. But we're going to allow them to continue in existing. So by allowing them to trade with the others, the correct among us, who have the right to exhale more CO2 than they have, this cap and trade, it's called. And today we're trying to figure out just exactly who's going to win and who's going to lose in this incredible piece of legislation that's working its way through Congress as we speak. We're going to pick up a little bit. We're going to go talk a little bit about now the restrictions that are going to be placed on everybody by cap and trade. But before we do, we're going to pick up Philip and talk with him a little bit about the global warming evidence. Go ahead, Philip. Are you there? Philip? Well, Philip's not there, so away we go. What kinds of new restrictions are going to be placed on us? John, I think it was you that mentioned the fact that there is going to be no restrictions placed on agriculture per se, but on everybody who serves agriculture, there will be restrictions. Is that true?
Generally true, but Michael, I think we need to kind of back up here a minute when we look at this issue and understand where we're at. And as a result of litigation, the Supreme Court has ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency must make a determination as to whether or not greenhouse gas emissions are a threat to public health. And as a result of that, the EPA has made that determination. They've said, yes, it is. And as a result, the default regulatory approach is that EPA will go forward and it will have its own regulatory regime as it goes forward, which will include pretty much just limitations. And within that structure, as you look at that, you have to compare that regulatory treatment of agriculture and the economy as a whole versus cap and trade.
So
now we're making a relative comparison here over which
is
the more flexible.
Yeah, just a sec, Rick. So what you're saying, John, is that it doesn't really matter. This is going to happen anyway.
The default is, in our view, the worst-case scenario, because in the EPA treatment, ag as a sector will not be exempted. There will be no ag exemption there, in our view, and that there's going to be certainly higher energy costs there, just as there is in cap and trade. But there will be no additional earned income for agriculture to participate in carbon sequestration programs where we're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and getting credit for it.
Where you're actually making some money on the deal.
And storing it in the soil and getting paid to do it. And that income is a very substantial new source of income, which
right.
will not be there with the EPA treatment.
Okay, Rick, how do you respond
yeah,
to that?
I think what he's saying about the possible impacts of EPA regulation are very true, that any EPA regulation, if it's left to go, will be very burdensome on people. However,
on everybody, it sounds like, right?
On everybody.
Clear across the board.
The situation is that EPA knows the consequences of their moving forward. Congress knows the consequences of what's going to happen with EPA regulation. And we have talked to a lot of people in Congress about this issue. And EPA regulation, and they assure us that if EPA were to promulgate these regulations or were in the process of doing it, that they would act to prevent the bad stuff from happening.
So you're just saying it isn't going to happen.
Hearing last week that where John's boss, his national president, and my national president both testified. Senator Lugar basically said at the hearing that he had enough people together to make sure that the devastating impact of EPA would not happen, and he called that threat just that.
Okay.
And there are some movements in Congress right now that would prevent EPA from regulating greenhouse gases, and we're hoping that we've communicated with John's organization to help us. To do that. So that's moving forward. Congress is aware of it. It's not going to be the bad issue that people are saying it's going to be.
Okay,
they're trying to play it off with legislation, and it's just not going to happen.
Okay, we're going to go quickly to Philip, who wants to follow up on a comment with respect to global warming evidence. Philip, are you there this time?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, gotcha. Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to come across with a couple of thoughts. Number one is there was a time in our history when only a very small minority of the people believed that the world was round. The rest believed it was flat. So
You mean it's round?
It's round. It's a ball. It's a sphere. Very few people believe that at one time, so the majority isn't always right. Secondly, I'd like to recommend people go on Amazon.com and look for a video. It's reasonably priced, called The Great Global Warming Swindle. It's put out by WAG TV in Britain, and there's also a website by that name, greatglobalwarmingswindle.com. On there, it points out that indeed there is a link between carbon dioxide and temperature. However, the troubling little fact is that the carbon dioxide responds to the temperature several hundred years later, not leading. So if indeed carbon dioxide causes the temperature to rise, there must be a time warp of some kind involved.
Okay, that's a good one. Philip, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Who's going to win and who's going to lose with cap and trade?
The elite who have rigged the system so that they're the ones that get the money will win. The rest of us will lose.
Fair enough.
It's a money transfer swindle deal. And I think that the honest people, and I think the people you have on your radio are honest, they're scrambling around trying not to get destroyed or not to get hurt by it. My philosophy is let the EPA go ahead and do their devastating regulation, and then when everyone is hurting enough, maybe we'll have a political shift in this country that'll set us straight. One last comment. I couldn't find it, but there's a Scientific American article several years old which has two theses. One is that man is causing global warming. Two, the second thesis is that it's a good idea because if we weren't causing global warming, we'd be deep into the next ice age, which is far more devastating than any warming you can imagine.
Well, having come from Montana, I might tend to agree with you there. Thank you so much for the call, Philip. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's go quickly back to the restrictions that are going to be placed on everybody by the EPA or by cap and trade or whatever. But somehow the government suggests that it's going to put a limit on how much we can emit. So what kind of limits are we talking about? What kind of restrictions? Let's say that we go with the cap and trade and agriculture itself is exempt. That means that I can still run around in the field with my tractor and plow things up and chug away with my diesel tractor. Fair enough. I'm off limits. Is that true? John?
Well, I think that the particulars of all of this are are all yet to be known, but when we look generally at what we've done before in cap and trade, it's been used successfully in the United States before to deal with different kinds of
particulates,
SOX, NOX, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
The Kyoto Protocol, for example, which the United States was not a signatory, which was put together in 1997, their target number was 5.2%. The Chicago Climate Exchange, which is a voluntary cap and trade system, and I encourage people to go to that website and look at the research that's available there and also how a voluntary system now works, which gives us kind of an idea of how these things might work. The level of emission reduction, binding reduction in emission caps there is a little more aggressive than the 5.2%.
And we have to hold that.
We
have to take a quick break, gentlemen. I'm going to put you both on hold. We have to take a quick break. We will be right back. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We're talking cap and trade, and you right back.
Okay, kids, the car's backed up and the campfire is out. Let's hit the road.
Dad, the fire's not out. You can see it's still smoking.
Close enough.
Close enough? If it's too hot to touch, then it's too hot to leave. You could burn down this forest. Not to mention our whole neighborhood. Come on, Dad, do your homework. 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans.
Did I say we were leaving? I was kidding.
Sure you were, Dad.
Are you gonna tell your mom about this?
Oh, yeah.
Great.
You're never too young to get your smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Because 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
A public service message brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Amanda, age 3. Tyler, age 8. Marissa, age 4.5.
We could tell you just how many child abductions last year led to Amber Alerts.
Shaniqua, age 14. Ryan, age 9.
But this isn't about cold statistics. It's about saving kids.
Terrell and Jamal, age 6 months.
Please go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up to get free Amber Alert text messages on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today for free at wirelessamberalerts.org. You can imagine what the family of an abducted child is feeling.
Alexander, age 7.
If you actually did help save that child, just imagine what that would feel like. WirelessAmberAlerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
Well, who's going to win and who's going to lose if cap and trade legislation is passed? It has passed the House. It is in the Senate. To get it passed the House, the farm representatives from farm states were told that, hey, you guys are going to be included in the good guys in cap and trade because you sequester carbon. You'll be able to sell carbon credits to those who need it, like coal-burning utilities and whatnot. You'll make tons of money. So it would seem like it would be a good deal for agriculture, and yet agriculture is kind of divided on the issue, with the National Farmers Union coming down on the side of cap and trade and the American Farm Bureau Federation coming down on the other side against cap and trade, saying that, hey, this is just going to make it really expensive to grow food here in the United States. It's going to make us less competitive. So we're going to look a little bit about what kind of restrictions are going to be placed on cap and trade. It seems like almost everything will have a kind of a tax on it. You know, the more I look at this, I think it's almost like a value-added tax on every breath we take and every move we make. Please tell me I'm wrong, Rick.
The way that farmers and ranchers are going to be impacted, it may not be by somebody saying you can't use your tractor. It's going to be by the tractor that they say you must use, and it's going to be the fertilizer that you must use, and the products that you have, that you use, the energy that you use in your operations. And all of that is going to be much more expensive than it is now.
Everything's going to be taxed all the way along the food chain, right?
It is, except...
For the farm
at
itself.
At the very top of the food chain, utility companies, for example, their costs are going to go up, but they pass those costs on to their consumers,
right,
which are farmers and ranchers. Farmers and ranchers cannot pass the costs, the increased cost that they have, onto their customers.
Mm-hmm. John, let me ask you. It seems to me that this cap and trade is a value-added tax on every breath we take and every move we make. Am I wrong? Please tell me I'm wrong.
I think that what they're trying to do is obviously reduce greenhouse gases, and that is being done for environmental purposes. Will there be an economic impact? Yes, there is. But one of the untold benefits of this entire regulatory system is that it also helps us as a nation develop a much more robust and aggressive and sustainable renewable energy-based production system within the United States. And that's good for the economy overall. We get a lot more economic benefit from getting our energy from the Midwest than we do from the Mideast. Midwest U.S. can be a part of that. The sheiks from the Mideast don't send us the thank you cards, and so we're importing all of this oil from abroad, from a lot of cases from folks who are absolutely counter to our national economic and national security and interests as a democracy. So energy sustainability and energy independence is a part of national security. It's good economic policy. It's good for the environment. And so you look at this kind of regulatory regime within a context of also helping incent renewable energy. Do we want to move toward renewable energy, or do we want to continue to be dependent on foreign oil?
John, let me ask you this. A couple weeks ago, I was up in Chico, California, which is a little farm town in the middle of California's Great Central Valley, probably the most fecund geography on the face of the earth, and ran across a little letter to the editor in the Chico newspaper. A parent was in the school paying for a school lunch, and he asked the lunch lady, hey, where does the food come from? The lady said, it comes from China. And she showed him the cans, and sure enough, the cans said, made in China. So here we have a California community right in the middle of California's Great Central Valley, and they're feeding their children food from China. Is this cap and trade going to make it possible for our farmers to be more competitive or less competitive?
Well, I think overall the entire food production system of moving the average amount of produced product from farmer to consumer of 1,200 miles is really built on cheap energy and a trade policy that really is not overall economically beneficial or sustainable to the United States or a lot of the rest of the world. And so as we go forward as a society, I think that getting food produced closer to home is going to be better for us in terms of food quality, but also
for a lot of other reasons. And if you want to make the case that what we're doing now doesn't make much sense when you look at it, I'm all for you because we're here we are. We're our dairy farmers. Your state of California is farmers or dairy farmers are going out of business right and left, and yet we're bringing in imported 5 to 7% of domestic fluid milk equivalent milk protein concentrate.
Yeah. Let me ask Rick really quickly. Rick, are we going to become more competitive or less competitive with cap and trade?
I think we're going to become less competitive. If cap and trade, and it imposes additional costs on our farmers and ranchers for fuel, fertilizer, and energy, and China and India and other countries in the world who we compete with in foreign markets don't have those kind of restrictions and therefore do not have those increased costs, our food is going to be priced higher, and we're going to be put at a competitive disadvantage in international markets.
Okay, folks,
so we're going to be less competitive.
This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Do stay tuned. Well, cap and trade, it's called. We're going to cap the emissions we allow people to emit, and we'll allow them to trade with others who emit less for the excess they need to get by. Who will win? Who will lose in cap and trade? Let's go quickly to Joe. Joe, welcome to the Food Chain. You're talking with Rick Krause from the American Farm Bureau Federation and John Hansen from the National Farmers Union and, of course, Michael Olson. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's something else that's coming from China, and that's pollution. And their carbon dioxide emissions are going to be coming over here, and there's no way to stop them. Yesterday there was someone brought up something about a dust storm that started in China and moved globally. So, you know, just if we basically hold our breath and limit the carbon dioxide emissions here, carbon dioxide, which is the cheapest fertilizer that there is, and we exhale it. But again, we're not an island, and it's going to be coming from China.
Are you suggesting that India and China are not going to go along with cap and trade?
No, they're not going to. They've said they're not going to.
Okay, thank you very much. John, how do you respond to that one?
The Kyoto Treaty was the first real test of whether or not the U.S. was going to participate with other nations.
Why didn't we sign it?
And, well, you tell me why we didn't sign it, but we didn't sign it. That's just the facts. And so, really, the public perception of the rest of the world is that the U.S. is the largest industrial nation in the world not to be a signatory to the Kyoto Treaty. So we took a walk.
Okay.
So we... it is very hard for us to get our other nations in the world to do the things that they also need to do if we're unwilling to do them ourselves. It's sort of like the parent telling the kid, do what I say,
and
not what I do.
Okay,
and
Rick,
if the U.S. expects to be a leader, we're going to have to do things that a leader does.
Okay, let me ask Rick why we didn't sign the Kyoto Accords.
Didn't sign the Kyoto Accord was the fact that a lot of these other countries that emit almost as much or the developing countries like China and India and Brazil didn't sign them as well and were not subject to these same restrictions. China right now is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. And if they don't participate in India, which is not far behind the United States, if they don't participate, then any kind of legislation that we do is not going to make one bit of difference.
Vernon,
the issue of leadership is not, if we really wanted to be leaders, we would have something in place to go and say, look,
this is what
if you guys do this, we're willing to do this as well. But it's not to go to have a law in place that limits your flexibility and you limits your negotiating position and binds you to something already. And then our only response will be, to plead with these other countries to go along with us. And China and India have already indicated that they are not going to accept any restrictions.
Okay, quickly to Vernon. Go ahead, Vernon.
Yeah, just very quickly, your guests keep using the term greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide interchangeably. I don't want to go into the science because we don't have time. Fact of the matter is, if all carbon dioxide contributed to the atmosphere by mankind was done away with, you would reduce its global warming effects by man by less than 1%. A terrible idea, a tremendous cost, for very little return.
Hey, Vernon, who's going to win?
Huh? Well,
who's going to lose?
The propagandists are going to win. The political cap and trade is going to go through, I think.
It's going to go through. Okay, thank you very much. John, who's going to win in cap and trade?
Well, I think if we do cap and trade right, and we expand the kind of treatment that we started with in the House, in the Senate, we make even more improvements. I think it can be very good for agriculture. I think it can also be overall positive for the U.S. economy as we develop a much more sustainable, renewable, energy-based energy system in
good
our
enough.
Country.
Rick, who's going to win cap and trade?
I think China and India are going to win. I think the Wall Street people that are going to be running these carbon markets are going to win as well, and I don't see any others.
All right, folks, thank you very much. This has been The Food Chain. We've been talking cap and trade with the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Farmers Union and you. We really appreciate you joining us today and hope you'll stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. And please, please remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.